I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Paul Tyson. He's an independent scholar and an honorary senior fellow with the School of Historical and Philosophical Inquiry at the University of Queensland in Australia. He has academic qualifications in philosophy, theology, and sociology, and likes to mix them all up when trying to understand how strange the ordinary features of our contemporary way of life are. Three of his biggest intellectual heroes are Plato, Kierkegaard, and Elul. Over the past few years, he's been writing in the science and religion domain, which has resulted in the 2022 book, A Christian Theology of Science, the 2021 book, Theology and Climate Change, and the 2019 book, Seven Brief Lessons on Magic. I would like to talk about Seven Brief Lessons on Magic today. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Right, Derek, wonderful to be with you.
So let's start with just the first sentence. The first chapter is, why does magic matter? And then the first sentence is, this book is about the reality of magic in an age of science. So what do you mean by magic? And also, why does magic matter?
Okay. So what I mean by magic is anything that science can't see. And I'm asking, are things that science can't see real? And this would be a crazy question for anyone else other than us historically. I don't know how it was when you went to uni, but when I went to uni, everything was deflationary. So I did philosophy, and it was all about why you couldn't believe in any sort of higher meaning. Everything is just about the grammar of words and arguments and what you can prove scientifically, and that's it. And when I did theology, same thing. It's all about religious texts, but never about God. It's like you couldn't go there. So the academic culture we live in is really deflationary of higher meaning. And I think higher meaning is basic to ordinary life. And if people aren't ruined by going to university, they can see that all the time. So I wanted to write a book about how the richness and beauty of the world is real, and we should take that seriously and treat it seriously rather than living in a very abstract way where we isolate meaning and purpose from sort of facts and power.
So I do better with examples than with analysis by itself. So you have an example on the first page there. Do you want to read it or should I? The one about love.
You read it, Derek.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go with the second paragraph too. So the second paragraph is, well, heck, I'm going to finish the first page, paragraph. The book is about the reality of magic in the age of science. It is about what the truth lens and science of lens can see and what it cannot see. It's also about non-scientific truths. Thankfully, science can see many things very clearly. For example, science can see how infections in our bodies work and what can be done to stop them. This has eliminated many common causes of death. Three cheers for the science. But while science can see and manipulate some very important aspects of reality, it remains remarkably blind to some other things. Science can see hormones, conditioned social behaviors, and biological necessities, but science cannot see love. Does this mean that really, love is only what science can see, and the magic of love is just made up? I'm sure hormones and so forth have a great deal to do with the human experience of love. But what about our sense of the intrinsic and transcendent meaning of love? Is it just an imagined and subjective gloss in the objective biological facts? Is love real in magical non-scientific terms, or can we only speak of reality itself in scientific terms? Another way of putting this question is to ask, are all poets liars? So respond to that in any way you want.
Yeah, well, like I was saying in more abstract terms, I'm about undeflating the meaning of the world. And we like deflating the meaning of the world because it makes pragmatic power justified. So when there's nothing sacred, you can do whatever you can get away with. And so This is very convenient for a pragmatic and instrumental age. However, it's going to wipe us out. So it's very serious that we need to recover concepts of sacred, concepts of sort of intrinsic meaning and higher value. And the fact that we live in with such infatuation with the technological world and the sort of the wonders of science makes us a bit blind to what we know to be truth in this area of meaning and purpose. So the minute you stop to ask, well, you know, is love real? And if what you mean by love is not simply, you know, chemicals and sort of instincts, but some sort of genuinely spiritual or transcendent value, obviously it's real, okay? Obviously nobody lives as if it's not real. Or if people do, they're really, really sad, right? So it's worth asking the question: are things that science can't see real? And then, how do we integrate our practical instrumental world with the real qualities and sacred meanings that are obviously there?
So I have three kind of large directions, and you can take any or none of these, or all. And the first one is introducing people to the sort of desacralization of the world that happened through the Enlightenment. That's one possibility. Another possibility is, and you and I discussed this last time we spoke, how there are many critiques to be made of science, and postmodernism has made perhaps the most stupid one of all, and it ends up sort of controlling society. I mean, frankly, I'd rather have the dogmatic science than dogmatic postmodernism if I had to make a choice between those two. But people might not know what we're talking about there, and I can see you, and I see you're nodding. So, and then the third one is, I think, and I'm springing this one on you, and I'm sorry for that, but I've thought for years that we have an intrinsic need. We humans, and probably bears and redwood trees, have an intrinsic need for a belief in something bigger, in the great mystery, in God, in the sacred, in whatever it is. And I'm not alone. Joseph Campbell was talking about this, many others, about how when one set of mythologies, you know, Nietzsche declared God is dead. And I think a lot of the insanity we see around us, you know, one story is done and there's not a new story if you don't want to talk about God, or you can talk about God. So you see what I'm sort of getting at with number three too, right? So any and or all three of those or none of them, that's your task.
Okay, Derek. Well, let's try bang through the three of them in a row and see what happens. I've got two chapters in my little book on disenchantment. One of them talks about how disenchantment did happen, and another one talks about how it didn't happen. So I think this is very important. The famous sociologist Max Weber comes up with this term disenchantment in 2018. Sorry, no, 1918. Sorry, I'm getting my centuries confused. It's a bit of a strange thing that he comes up with it then, because all his friends are having seances and everyone's going sort of crazy about the parapsychological at that time. A lot of the physicists who are very famous were really getting into sort of bizarre experiments, you know, and been very attracted to Eastern philosophy. So what Weber means by disenchantment is a very complicated thing. It doesn't actually mean that the, you know, the uncanny and the mystical and the sort of inexplainable disappears, but what it means is We start to look at the world as if there are no spirits in the water holes, as if there are no sort of symbolic meanings that the moon has for us, as if the natural world is just stuff rather than intrinsically meaningful. And so, and he's right, that happened. And it happens as a result of the Enlightenment. It happens as a result of concerted attempts to separate science from religion in the 19th century. And the success of those attempts to demagic the world, which has been going on for a long time, and people who study these sorts of things in history of science notice that theology actually demagics the world before modern science arrives. And and this goes back to the 16th century with this idea of natura pura. It's a theological idea where the physical world doesn't need divine grace. It's self-standing in its own right. And after that, you get the idea, okay, well, you know, then the natural world is separated from the supernatural world, and the supernatural world does its own thing, but the natural world doesn't need the supernatural world for anything. So God put us in charge of the natural world so we can do whatever we like with it. And we don't have to worry about, you know, not mining because that offends the sacred dignity of the earth. We don't have to worry about all the sort of natural rhythms and seasons having sort of special significance. We can just master it ourselves and take over. And this is what Bacon does with the scientific revolution. For theological reasons, he wants to dominate and control nature. So once you've separated the natural from the supernatural so that the natural is in purely self-standing, it's natura pura, then you get the possibility of this very instrumental approach to nature. So theology produces the separation between nature and supernature, and theology produces instrumental science. And over time, science doesn't need theology. And then all you've got is a flat material world with no meaning. And
means you've got a world well on its way to being killed.
Absolutely. So Weber is describing that disenchantment as something which genuinely has gone on. The funny thing is it also doesn't happen, okay, because it's just impossible. You have to be – people might think that there's no meaning to the world, but nobody actually lives that way, right? If you thought there was really no meaning, the only sensible thing to do is top yourself. Every now and then people, you know, we all dip into depression, right? Every now and then we all have dark moments, but you can't actually live in that continual state of darkness where there's no sense of meaning and purpose to the world. And very simple things like having a nice meal with a friend is intrinsically meaningful. There's something that's more than simply a physical thing going on there. So even if
something more than simply, I ingested 27 calories of carbohydrates, 54 calories of protein, a little bit of vitamin A.
That's right. Nobody actually thinks like that. Nobody actually lives like that. So our practice is separated now from our theory. So we've got this theory that the world is just meaningless stuff, and this is very integral with our approach to science and technology, but our actual lives can't actually live like that because it's just abstract nonsense. Okay.
Which, by the way, was one of the reasons that I've always been appalled by Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene. And one of the things I understood, even when I was much, much, much younger, was that even if you don't have kin, you know, he would have this with, you know, sharing selfish genes. At a table, if somebody says, could you please pass the potatoes, nobody acts as the selfish gene would suggest that you act. Nobody hoards the potatoes because there are these things called relationships. And it doesn't merely have to do with making sure the other person doesn't knife you in the night. I mean, there's just, it's a reading that book. And it was the same thing happened with learning about how capitalism works. It's like capitalism only ends up applying, all their rules only end up applying on these huge scales, that there is no supply and demand at the dinner table. And if you have a functioning family, I mean, it can break down during time of starvation or something, or it can, but under normal circumstances, you know, there are these things called relationships that are intangible. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you find people like Thucydides way back in ancient times, looking at sort of exploring what happens to people under conditions of siege. And, you know, under conditions of siege, normal human life breaks down. And you can read this two ways. You can say, well, actually, normal human life is just some sort of game that's pasted over the top of pure selfish interest, right? You can read it that way, like perhaps Richard Dawkins reads it. He would probably even read it in a more mechanical way and say, well, it's not even selfishness, or it's not even human selfishness. It's simply your genes using you. You think you're in charge, but actually you're just a puppet of your genes. And they don't care. They're just trying to replicate. I don't know why they're trying to replicate themselves, but so anyway, we won't get into Dawkins. But so you can read the human condition under extremes to say, well, actually, that's what we really are. We're just selfish bastards who will eat our own children if we have to, right? Or you can say, well, that's completely abnormal. Normal life doesn't function like that. Normal life is premised on trust and kindness and generosity and justice and value and meaning. And these are the real things. And that reality can be stressed out. But even you also see under conditions of incredible stress, you see astonishing acts of generosity and kindness, where people sacrifice their lives for the sake of those they love. I mean, it's not like we all just turn into monsters. We all have, you know, a self-preservation desires and instincts that are very strong. And if we don't control them, we can be, you know, selfish bastards under normal circumstances. And some institutions encourage that sort of behavior. And there's a great little book by, I think it's Ronson, what's it called? Oh, dearie me. The Psychopathy Test, where he talks about CEO culture encourages self-interested, ambitious bastards and rewards them. So you can set up cultural situations that promote what's base and inhumane and instrumental in us, and you can reward that. But the consequence of that is everyone who works in organizations like that is treated like lunch, and nobody feels happy, right? And the whole thing's a huge mess. And when you work in a place where your boss actually wants to facilitate your work, everything thrives. And this is how human life really should be. So you can read the situations of extreme as revealing that really we're just horrible things underneath. And or you can reveal it as saying that's abnormal and ordinary life is actually incredibly good. Ordinary life, when you cross the road, people don't run you over. And there are basic customs of respect and dignity and meaning and goodness and kindness in normal life. And if they're not there, something's gone wrong. So in bringing back to your first point about disenchantment, there are long stories in the history of Western culture, and particularly since the 17th century, in making us more pragmatic, more instrumental, in separating the sacred from the mundane, in ways that are bizarre, that no other culture's ever done. And we think that's kind of normal now, but in fact, we're really strange in the history of humanity. And that strangeness, that disenchantment has happened at that level, at the level of our understanding and the level of our instrumental practices. But still, in ordinary life, in daily manners, in what you talk about in relationships, nobody lives like that. Nobody accepts that that is actually the truth of how things are. So disenchantment, I think, can't happen at a fundamental level, because nobody can actually live as if we're just machines, as if we're just selfish machines. So have a look in the magic book at those two aspects of how disenchantment did happen, and we should really understand that, and how disenchantment didn't happen, and we need to hold on to it not having happened, and recover this categories of the sacred and the intrinsically valuable in ordinary life and in the way we use power and technology. So this skips down to the second point you said. When we compare the postmodern critique of science with old-fashioned modernism, you can almost prefer that we were back in the 20th century with Bertrand Russell and people like that who were kind of actually believed in facts. So let's look at this. This is a really important point. I've spent a lot of time in the last month looking at Immanuel Kant. I don't know if you've ever dug into Immanuel Kant when you were at uni, Derek?
A little bit. In my 20s, I did this thing where I thought I should read at least one book by every major philosopher. And so I would do them 10 pages every night. And I can't remember who was that. At some point in the way, there was a philosopher who cured me of that forever by being so impenetrable that. But I don't.
Hegel,
I don't remember
I
who it was.
Imagine.
What?
Probably Hegel.
Yeah, I think Hegel might have been the one who cured me of philosophy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, I did do some Kant, but it's been 40 years.
Okay, so. You probably crunched through the Critique of Pure Reason, or
yeah,
at least had a go at it.
No, I did. I actually made it through that one.
Well done. That's amazing. I'm impressed. So it's an absolutely pivotal text in modern philosophy.
Wait. I just have to say, reading it versus understanding it might be two entirely different questions.
Well, I think it's a bit like Woodstock. If you could understand it, you probably weren't there. So let me get... I don't think the Critique of Pure Reason makes sense. So if you didn't understand it, I think you're right.
So you just saw 40 years of insecurity. Thank you.
Yes. And there's a beautiful little book by Roger Scruton in the very brief introduction series by Cambridge called Just Can't. Where he sort of has a really good overview of the problems with Kant that are still there after 200 years. Even though Scruton loves Kant, which I can't say I do. But anyway, so the basic idea of Kant is, I would boil down to the concept of the limits of knowledge. So Kant is saying, when it comes to understanding the world, we don't actually understand the world. We only understand the world as we perceive it. And let's limit our understanding to phenomena. Let's limit our understanding to the world as we experience it, rather than trying to work out what the world is in itself, which he calls noumena. Okay, so what this does is it gets rid of metaphysics and theology, right? All you need now is your own experience. And in your own experience, we've got the rational and the empirical. And we can unify these together in our own experience. And those things that we can understand rationally and we can understand empirically, we can take as valid knowledge. And anything that we can't get inside our little boxes of rational and empirical knowledge, let's treat as speculative hoo-ha. And so he has problems, okay, and he wants to keep morality, he wants to keep that sort of stuff, and he does it by saying, well, look at practical life rather than metaphysics. And he does some brilliant attempts to try and keep morality going on purely logical and purely scientific basis. I don't think it works at all, but he tried hard. The problem is, after Kant, everyone basically takes up this idea that you can't know reality itself. And therefore, you know, the idea that there is a divine mind outside of my own mind becomes unimportant. The idea that there is intrinsic meaning outside of whatever meaning I give to things becomes unimportant. And this leads, as night follows day, to anti-naturalism and to anti-essentialism and to postmodern bullshit. So unfortunately,
this is pissing me off because he makes a reasonable assumption: this we can know, this we can't know. This is why I both like and hate philosophy, because that makes perfect sense to me. We can know this, we don't know this. So it's perfectly acceptable to say, I'm going to limit my exploration to this. But what's not acceptable, and what's really stupid, is the implication that dreams don't mean anything because you can't control them. Yes. But all this other stuff that you, and this gets me with science too, that you, in a scientific experiment, you say we're going to eliminate every variable except one, and we're going to do it in a lab, and then that's great. And it's a very powerful tool for learning how, if you reduce everything to one variable, what's going to happen. And then you release it on the world. And that's nuts. It's just, yes, it's the same sort of thing. And sorry, I know this is your interview and not mine, but I'm sorry my voice is getting thin and reedy, but this just annoys me no end. Because it's a thought error that we see all the time. I'm going to be very clear about my premise, that my premise is we're just caring about this right now. That doesn't mean this is bad. And then all of a sudden, two generations later, the other doesn't exist anymore.
Yes. And that's exactly what's happened to the sacred. Okay. So there's a really great Irish philosopher, William Desmond. He's alive now. Fabulous guy. And he has a sensational critique of Kant. And he says, well, Kant's wrong. Okay. So if you ever felt insecure, go and read William Desmond. And he said, it's not like you can actually ever completely master rational and empirical knowledge. You can't. Okay. The more you try and get a really tight handle on only what I can understand, and you only base it on subjective experience and subjective understanding of your own life, you just lose complete contact with reality. And this is what's happened in postmodernism. And so William says it's not like what Kant thinks. What happens is we live in between an empirical material reality we can never finally understand, and between a transcendent meaningful reality we can never master. So you have to be able to sit in this middle space and be porous to what's above our understanding and what's beneath our understanding, and treat both with respect. And so this way you can integrate a a good understanding of factual science with a sense of meaning and purpose that you can never put in a scientific bottle, right? And this is how everyone did it before Kant. So, but one of the crazy things about Kant is he wrote this fantastic little essay called What is Enlightenment? And it's a sensational piece of propaganda, and we still believe it. And he basically says, well, enlightenment is being grown up. And when you're grown up, you don't believe all that superstitious rubbish from the past. You only act with reason and science, like me. and we still think that. We still think that the medievals and the, you know, the classics and everyone else, the superstitious, you know, Neanderthals who had no idea about actually what really is the case, and we're the super mature, grown-up, smart people who know everything. So it's just the funny thing is, in the name of humility, of the limits of knowledge, it's an unbelievable hubris of saying, well, we're the really smart people because we don't believe in things that you can't prove anymore. But in fact, everything that's important you can't prove. You ask particle physicists what matter is, nobody knows. Right?
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
So you ask a theologian what God is, they don't know, right? All the things that really matter to us are beyond our knowledge. And we have this thin little band in the middle that you should take seriously. You should take seriously the knowledge we do have, but you shouldn't make it God. You shouldn't make it what we make our own knowledge God, okay? We make our own ability to master rational empirical knowledge the grounds of judging everything, and that's just rubbish. You have to be open to what you can't master to be true to what you can understand.
So gravity, for me, forms a really great example that
fantastic.
Anybody who doesn't fall off a cliff and die, and everybody does fall off a cliff and die, understands gravity. And on one hand, we have physicists, I'm a physicist myself, who we don't actually know the mechanics by which gravity works. It's a black box, you know? Like, okay, there's that thing, there's this thing, they have a gravitational attraction. We don't actually know why, which is fine with me. And on the other hand, I know that not many people...
Gravity is complete magic.
I'm happy to say that. And on the other hand, I've heard some postmodernists say that gravity is dependent on one's belief. And that, that's one of the reasons I can't stand postmodernism.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're playing semantic games. So the postmodernists are saying, there might be a physical world out there, but the only tools we've got to handle it are human words, and human words are entirely made up by us. And you can only experience gravity if you've got the word for it, and then it's just it's kind of like
which is nonsense, because if they, and I'm not suggesting anybody do this, but if they drop a newborn baby off of a cliff and the newborn baby does not yet have any words, the newborn baby still falls.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just the whole, and if we presume, as they do, presumably, that Tyrannosaurus rexes had no language, I would argue they probably did, but let's presume they didn't.
Then they could fly.
Yeah, exactly. The whole thing's just... And it goes back to that
fly,
thing. As soon as you decide that all the stuff's out, it's fine if you decide you only care about the stuff inside the box, but we forget that we consciously forgot about it and we made up. There's a great line I've just used for years, which is unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture. Or another way to put this is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. And yes. And we don't really have to go here, but I think this is an important line. It was said of Hitler, By this might have been Robert J. Lifton or some other famous person who analyzed Hitler. From insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. So you would have this crazy premise, and then once you, and the premise comes in the first sentence of his speech. What are we going to do about the Czechoslovakian problem? Presumably the Czechoslovakian problem we got to do something about. What are we going to do about the Jewish problem, the Austrian problem, et cetera, et cetera. He always did that. And, you know, obviously a lot of people fell for it.
Yes.
Very powerful tool. Anyway, sorry, go ahead. Everything you're saying is great so far. I'm really enjoying this.
Right. Okay, we'll skip along to the third point you raised, which is sort of the inescapable need for what we might call big meaning. I think you're totally right. I don't really sort of mind how people approach this, just so long as you approach it. I'm a Christian theologian, and so I operate about big meaning within a framework of what are called sacred doctrines in the Christian tradition. So most people who think about big meanings operate within some framework that they didn't make up. I think that's almost functionally necessary to really do this properly. We live in a period in the West where all those big frameworks have been massively eroded, and the benefit of that is a bit like the Hitler thing. Okay, so if you have religious authorities that are respected in the society, and there's a particular view about justice. Now, your view about justice, say in the English legal system, is that the crown is a sacrament of divine authority. Right? Now, you may think that's, you know, particularly as an American, maybe that this is kind of total moonshine, but there was a commonly accepted understanding of what authority should look like, and there were frameworks that sovereignty had to operate within that were not up to the king, right? So when you've got a whole society that accepts a religious authority that puts limits on power, then your power has got its limits. The minute you don't have any agreed central authority, power is whatever you can get away with. So we look a bit scarily across the Pacific Ocean at America, and the political discourse is becoming, well, political discourse in my own country is crazy, but there is no high concept of what the difference between authority and power is anymore, because we don't have an agreed civic sort of cultural category of the sacred authority in our society anymore. So this is kind of straying a bit, but all I'm trying to say here is that in all societies until our own, there has been categories of sacred meaning that are, and authorities within the society that uphold those categories. And we live in the crazy situation where we don't have any agreed authorities about sacred meaning. And this has the beautiful effect, if you're a powerful and pragmatic person, of letting you do whatever you can get away with. So, but the problem with that is we're going to bump up against natural limits. We are bumping up against natural limits, because if you treat the world just like a fridge you can raid any time, any way you like, in the end, it'll be empty and we'll all starve. So the idea of all cultures that have a functional categories of higher meaning is that there are orders that you can't violate even if it's in your to your advantage to do so. So we've kind of lost that big framework in our culture, and I think it's having a terribly destructive effect on us. How you fight that is a complicated issue. I don't know on a big level, but on a personal level, I think everyone kind of knows there's big meaning, and you need to find it however you can find it.
And I think that would be a great place to end, but we still have 6 or 7 minutes left. And I have, there's a quote I want to read that's always been very important to me. It's by Joseph Campbell. I think it applies to some of this. For those in whom a local mythology still works, there is an experience both of accord with the social order and of harmony with the universe. And he wrote this in the 60s. For those, however, in whom the authorized signs no longer work, or working produce deviant effects, there follows inevitably a sense both of dissociation from the local social nexus and of quest, within and without, for life, which the brain will take to be for meaning. And what that says to me is, if the signs and symbols of Catholicism connect you to a sense of the divine and connect you to your community and connect you, bring meaning to your life, then you've got a path that's a couple thousand years old that is ready for you. And if they don't work for you, then you go on what Campbell would call the hero journey. And that's all fine, but the signs and symbols of so many of these various stories have broken down for so many. And it's fine if one individual in the community goes on a hero quest. But the problem is that those old stories, I think, are working for so few people. And that's one reason that we collectively are grasping at so many insane things like postmodernism. Stop me anytime you want to give a much better lecture on this than I'm doing. Presuming you agree.
Ah, totally, Derek. So the funny thing is that it's natural for people to grow up in cultures where there are signs and meanings and a connection between mythos and the way we actually practically live, right? So in my family, we say grace every meal. We still have these little micro practices of thankfulness to divine provision. And not many families I know do that. Not many families I know actually eat together. So everything about our world is trying to erode our little tiny bubble of mythic life, right? And so this is not simply accidental. So the iPhone, the way we're all being algorithmically processed to be, you know, meaningless consumers, actively erodes these social and cultural and familial and community practices of meaning that have sustained human life for millennia until now. So I think we have to fight back. We have to look at our technology very carefully and realize what it's doing to us at a spiritual level and fight back.
So I love everything you're saying. And the interruption I want to make here is that part of the whole thing that is very important to my analysis is we will worship a God. And whether that God is, in your case, capital G God, I presume, or whether it's, in my case, some sort of animistic spirit imbuing all the earth, imbuing everything, or whether it is technology, or whether it is capitalism, we are, maybe I should ask you, what does it mean to worship? I mean, because first off, do you agree with what I just said?
Totally. So I think there are two big alternatives here, okay? You worship the divine, however you understand that, or you worship yourself. And everything in our culture tries to make us self-worshippers, which in the Christian tradition we call idolatry. And so there is this fundamental need for a center of worth, which is what the word worship refers to. What's your first basis of worth? And we understand the world to be about valuing what is worthy, and our own lives are good lives if we live in a way that values and lives in value of what's worthwhile. So, and we're told by our consumer culture that everything revolves around me, right? And this is spiritually toxic, right? And anything you can do to be connected to other people and the world, the physical world you actually live in, works against that idolatry. And we need to all be anti-idolatrous, whatever our theology, whatever our philosophy. And you can be a great materialist and be anti-idolatrous in that sense.
So there are reputable studies I've seen that suggest that college students, their narcissism has increased by like 3 times since the early 80s to 2011, I think the study was completed. And it was based on questions like, you have 2 sandwiches, your friend doesn't have a sandwich, you're eating lunch, do you give him one of them? And I had always sort of presumed, and excuse me, and I hope nobody yells at me for this, but I always presumed that it was like somehow bad parenting or something. But what you're suggesting here is it's an entire emphasis of the self and a worship of the self is being manifest in the way one would expect that a culture promoting the worship of the self would manifest.
Yes. So I've got 4 children aged 23 to 14. So the oldest was kind of a bit ahead of the iPhone generation. But the impact of social media and the iPhone on the way young people socialize is just enormous. And so we tried to have a family and a church and a community environment where the center of value is outside of the self, and where, you know, love God and love your neighbor are the 2 great commandments. And love God, love your neighbor as yourself. It's okay to love yourself, but as your neighbor, right? Whereas everything in this, the technological communicative sort of impact of this culture on this younger generation is to make themselves the center of everything, and they are socially insecure. They are insulated in their echo chambers of virtual communities in a way where everything revolves around them, and they can withdraw at any moment without personal cost, and it's absolutely dehumanizing. And my children, who I think we've given everything we can to not go in that direction, really struggle with it. So I think if you weren't making a conscious effort, what would happen? Your kids would just get sucked into this kind of very, very powerful world. Like the people who write these, you know, these AI assisted algorithmic monitors of our every interest on the and action on the computer are unbelievably brilliant, and you can't beat them. It doesn't matter how smart you are, they'll get you. So we have to have very deliberate skepticism about what the technology we're using is doing to our very humanity, or else we're just going to be, you know, post-human.
Well, that also would be a good note to end on, but I want for you to tell people how they can find out more about your excellent work.
Great. Well, I really recommend my little book, 7 Brief Lessons on Magic. It's
a great book. I really enjoyed this book.
Thanks, Derek.
I want to just say, You know, I am not a Christian. I'll tell you my animism story sometime off camera. I'm totally animistic is my, if I had to claim a religion, that would be it. But I just love your stuff. It doesn't. So my point is, Christianity, I hope you don't want me saying this, Christianity gets such a bad rap these days, among so many, I don't know, secular humanists or something, that I just want to say, I want to make sure that people don't let that put them off. I think your stuff's brilliant.
Yeah, thanks, Derek. And I love your stuff. I mean, I don't think narrow sort of camp issues, you know, whether you're in my theological camp or not, really matter. We're on the same team when it comes to the sacred, right?
last interview, you made that explicit, that the question is whether you, you know, whether you're defending the sacred or not.
Yes.
I'm totally, I'm totally down for that. I don't actually care what religion it is. I think that there is sacredness to be found.
Yeah, so I write shamelessly as a Christian theologian.
That's great.
In no sense, in a way, to put people who aren't Christians off. That's how I try and write.
So, and you succeeded that very well. Ben, sorry for even bringing this up, but I think that's really important because a lot of my audience is probably not capital C Christian.
Sure. Yeah, we've got a very bad press. Yeah.
Anyway, so how do they find out about your work?
Well, you probably just the best thing to do is put Paul Tyson, Seven Brief Lessons on Magic into your algorithmic search machine, and you can buy my books online through various online outlets. They're published with Whipton stock, so they don't actually have distribution in bookshops, but you can buy them online.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Paul Tyson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.